both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's a big day for the Racine Theater Guild. Essentially, for the first time since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Racine Theater Guild is opening its doors to the general public for live theater. And with a very, very happy and joyous production of A Christmas Story. And I'm really pleased that I can speak with Doug Instanis, Artistic and Managing Director of the Racine Theater Guild, first of all, to talk a little bit about the long process which takes them to this moment, and, of course, find out a little bit as well about this production of A Christmas Story, an adaptation of the very popular Christmas film, with performances running this weekend, next weekend, and the following weekend as well through Sunday, December 19th. Doug Instanis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Really
it's
glad
been
to
a
be,
while.
Yeah, and glad to be talking with you, and glad that we can be talking about something like the opening night of a production at the Racine Theater Guild with live people sitting in the audience for the first time since the onset of COVID. Did you ever think you'd get to this point?
Well, my emotions went up and down weekly. I had probably four different plans, and, you know, we're going to just postpone for a while. Well, then we're going to change things for a while, and then we're going to, cancel for a while, and then we're going to cancel for a longer period of time. And there was just different types of things in place. Our patrons were so understanding when we said, well, we're postponing. Well, now we're canceling. Well, now we're doing this. And every time we've made a change, they've been very supportive of that. And but it's frustrating and not knowing. You know, we plan a year and a half to 2 years out, and then just sitting around here trying to come up with a plan and not knowing, where we're going to be. I don't think anybody thought it was going to be this long. Mm. So, yes, we're extremely excited. A little scared because we want to stay open. So we're doing everything we can to make sure that the Theater Guild can stay open.
Right. I know when we had one of our first conversations during COVID that you talked about how much attention you were paying to other theater companies and what they were doing and how they were handling this new and very unhappy situation. And that, I mean, there were a lot of conversations kind of going back and forth with directors of maybe comparable community theaters and maybe other kinds of theaters as well. I mean, lots of back and forth. I'm curious now at this point in time, for instance, earlier this year and into the fall, how much you've paid attention to other theater companies, especially community theaters that have already opened, and to what extent it was helpful to pay attention to other companies versus unhelpful because maybe their situation was a bit different from the Racine Theater Guild's.
Well, they are all over the place. There are theaters in the South that I don't know if they ever shut down. They continued to perform all through this. Then Broadway, of course, closed down. All regional theaters closed down. So, and many of us shut down. Some of them have reopened, and they have strict vaccination policies, wearing masks, very strict protocols. When you go to a Broadway show, you need to show your vaccination card. When you go to the Milwaukee Rep and theaters in Milwaukee, you need to show your vaccination card. So we've been studying the wide variety of policies that different theaters have done. Now, the Theater Guild is kind of in the middle. We are requiring the audience to wear masks, but we are not requiring proof of vaccination. You know, that'll be make some people angry, some people not angry. You know, there is no right answer to all this. I wish we had a magic ball that could just tell us that this is the way we should do it, but that's the way the board of directors of the Theater Guild chose to do that. We've got some strict policies backstage. We're not selling refreshments. The crew has to be masked. We have social distancing in all of our dressing rooms. You know, the audience can't come down and see the cast. We're not doing any entrances from audience. You know, so we've got some protocols in place to try to keep everybody safe. But you never know what happens. My wife designed costumes for a professional production in Milwaukee, and they ended up having to cancel the last weekend because of COVID. One of the actors got sick, and so they had to shut down. So we're hoping that's not going to be the case at the Theater Guild. Our goal is to be open and stay open.
Hmm. Have you been jealous of other companies nearby that have opened ahead of this? Or by and large, have you felt pretty confident and secure about the fairly cautious approach that the Guild has taken through all this?
Well, I have an interesting job at the Theater Guild. I am the managing and artistic director. So depending on the day, one side of my brain works harder than the other side of my brain. So this, when we first shut down, to me, it was all about money, losing money, and can we survive this? Were we going to be able to come out of this? That, you know, when other theaters were doing shows, they were continuing to get revenue. Well, because of different grants we were able to receive, and because of the generosity of our donors, we don't have to worry about the money aspect anymore. We don't have to open to make money to keep the pay the heating bill, and you know, we're fine. We're in great shape. The generosity from the community has been amazing. So then I can just worry about my volunteers and my staff and the patrons, and that. You know, I want everybody to be safe. I can think long term. I can think about this. You know, we have lots of seniors. We have lots of compromised people here. We have kids. Their safety is the most important. So I don't have any problem with staying closed. And until we could try to do this safely and make sure that my cast and the audience is safe. You know, we talk about the Theater Guild being a family, and the most important thing is to keep that family safe. So other theaters chose not to, and I don't know what their situation is. To me, that looks reckless and that they don't care about their volunteers or their patrons. But, you know, I don't know their situations. So we weren't going to open until we could do it safely and try to minimize any risk to our volunteers and our audience. Mm.
So opening night is here tonight, and I should think that it's thrilling to finally reach this point. How complicated has it been in terms of the logistics of this particular opening night versus opening night for a more normal season and a more normal production?
Well, in general, it's the blocking, and the show has direct address, and when I directed it 20 years ago, I used the audience for entrances and things like that, which we're not using. We're keeping the actors distant from the audience. The you know, in rehearsals, we had masks on. That complicated some things for a while. But in general, I think there's such an enthusiasm about being back and actually doing theater and being together. It's really, you know, I've always said you don't appreciate something until it's taken away from you. And this is the longest drought I have been in 30 some years without doing a play. And so I think we're all just so thrilled to be back together and to create something. And Christmas Story is such a wonderful story to tell, and it just makes you feel good. So, you know, we're all having a great time. We're very excited. We're a little nervous about the audience and are they willing to follow the protocols that we need to keep open. But in general, we're just thrilled to be back at doing something we love to do.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Doug Instanis, Artistic and Managing Director of the Racine Theatre Guild. And the Racine Theatre Guild opens its doors to the general public tonight with the opening of its production of A Christmas Story, with performances that are running this weekend, next weekend, and the following weekend through Sunday, December 19th. Doug Instanis, I don't think there's too many people on the face of the earth that have not seen the film A Christmas Story, but maybe for the sake of anybody listening who is not familiar with this film and its basic story, maybe you could outline that for us, and maybe also along the way kind of give us a sense of the relationship between the film and this stage adaptation of it.
Yeah, it's pretty much based on the movie. Now, there's some things that are different, and some things that are added, some things that are deleted just because of the theatrical purposes of it. The main difference in the play is that it is narrated by the older Ralphie. So we have Ralph as the older person looking back at his childhood, and Ralphie, the younger version of himself. So Ralph narrates the play, and basically it's a family, late 40s, early 50s, in Indiana, and the excitement around Christmas and getting your turkey and getting presents. And little Ralphie, the only thing he wanted in his life is a Red Ryder BB gun, you know, and so he constantly dropping hints about that to his parents, and hopefully he'll get it. And they keep saying, "You're going to shoot your eye out." That's the ongoing theme of the story. And in this version, he does a lot of daydreaming. So he dreams about him being a Western hero, and he dreams, and when he gets in trouble because he, says a bad word, then and he gets his mouth washed out with soap, then he has a little fantasy scene about him getting soap poisoning and going blind. And, there's a lot of nostalgia about years gone by and family and listening to Little Orphan Annie on the radio and getting a decoder pin in the mail. And there's a line, "Nothing's more exciting for a kid to get something in the mail," you know. And so it's really about family. It's about Christmas and what's important. And, you know, I don't think I'm giving this away, but the dad's so excited about Christmas and having turkey, and then the neighborhood dogs steal the turkey from him, and they have to make different plans. And then in the movie, there's the flagpole scene where a little kid gets double dog dared to put his tongue on the flagpole, and it gets stuck. You know, that's a favorite scene in the movie. The dad wins a major award, which is a leg lamp, which is, you know, one of the big fun things in the movie that's in the play. So we've got, you know, the life-size leg lamp on stage, and Bob Benson did our lobby, and there's, I think, five or six leg lamps in our lobby now. So so it's just basically about family and Christmas and what's important and memories of, you know, when we're adults now, we look back at a simpler time, and we kind of long for that. We miss that, especially and I think it speaks today with the technology that we have. And, you know, we kind of are into our technology, and this play really speaks to what's really important, and that's family. So it's a great, great fun. It's a little challenging putting a movie on stage because there's lots of little scenes. But our stage is unique in the fact that we can move quickly from one location to another location. So we think we did that pretty well.
You've already touched on the fact that you are reshaping some of the staging in accordance with COVID protocols. Aside from all of that, which is, you know, certainly significant, I also would be curious to know what it's like for you to reapproach a play that you have directed in the relatively recent past. I mean, it's been a couple decades, but nevertheless. And to have what I presume is an entirely different cast. How hard is it to, in a sense, forget that previous production and that previous cast? And should you? I mean, are there ways in which remembering what happened before can be helpful for this new production, or is it better to go into it with as much of a blank slate of amnesia as possible?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I hem and haw about that because last time we did it, I think we played for 4 or 5 weekends and sold out almost every performance. It was such a huge hit. And my memory of it was that there was a lot of challenges putting a movie on stage. And we chose to do a non-realistic set with platforming and presence and things that could easily be different locations. And that allowed freedom of movement from the actors to be able to exit stage left, exit stage right, come up in the center, a lot more freedom of movement in the first set that I did. So I didn't experience some of the issues that I did this time around. Now, the nice thing about the first set was the flexibility of movement. The difficulty was that it was also a little colder because it didn't have the nostalgia. It didn't have the real bedroom, and it didn't have the roof and the fences and the realistic kitchen. And so a lot of that nostalgia that you see on the Norman Rockwell posters, we didn't have. So this time around, we decided to go with a more realistic set, which I think is very helpful in setting the nostalgia of the show, the carpeting, the furniture, the radio, the antique sinks and things like that. So we have that. The difficulty was in trapping actors and trying to get them to do some of the things, and they're trapped in a bedroom on the second floor. How are they going to get down? How are they going to do their costume change? So that was very different. So the blocking was all different. I did go back and watch the other movie just because I wanted to remember what I liked and what I didn't like about it.
You mean the video camp. The video of the previous production?
Yes, we do have an archival video that is like a one camera in the back, and just to see a little bit how I staged it and how we approached it. And because of the set, it was totally different. And then, you know, I have different actors, and different actors bring different gifts and different ideas. And so they throw in their 2 cents. And so it's a very different production. I have fond memories of the first one, and I have very fond memories of this one. So they're very different, mostly because of the set and how I block things and, you know, what is stylized and what is realistic. That's the major difference between the 2 shows. And then the cast brings a whole different energy. This cast is a little older because we did require the actors to be vaccinated. So that instead of having, you know, 9-10-year-olds, we have 12 to 14-year-olds just because of those circumstances. So, you know, that's a little bit different than having a 9-year-old running around. So it's different, and it's kind of fun because I can fix what I didn't like the first time around. You know, I can go back and look at it. And since it's my work anyway, I can steal what I want and I can change what I want. And it's been fun. I don't often get a chance to redirect things like that. So it was kind of fun to relive those memories. And my overall feeling is, where are these kids now? I want to go look them up. You know, they're all probably in their 30s. They probably have kids of their own now and married and going on with their lives. And it's like, so I need to find out where my old cast is, what happened to those kids.
Right. And I should think that for this cast of actors, at least I'm guessing for most of them, this is their first time back on stage and in a production that will be performed for a live audience. At least the majority of them, I should think, this represents something really special.
They are. Some of the kids were in in class plays with masks on and kind of limited. So, but none of the adults have done a play in 2 years. And so I think everybody's just excited to be back and being creative. And, you know, there's been a lot of negativity and a lot of sadness and a lot of hardship. And to be able to do something fun that has a good message, people are just thrilled just to do something fun. So we're having a great time doing it, and I hope the cast, I mean, I hope the audience will enjoy our efforts.
If people are interested in tickets for A Christmas Story at the Racine Theater Guild, what do they do?
They should call the box office at 262-633-4218, or you can go online at racinetheater.org and order tickets online. I think a couple of the performances actually are sold out. It's going fast. But please remember, if you do choose to come, that masks are required. You will need to wear a mask at the Theater Guild.
Very good. Doug Instanis, Artistic and Managing Director of the Racine Theater Guild and the director of this production of A Christmas Story, with which the Racine Theater Guild reopens its doors to the general public. Doug Instanis, thanks for making time for this interview in a busy week. Best wishes to you and the cast and crew of A Christmas Story.
Thank you, Greg.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive.
What an intriguing story is before us today. And the title of the book does not fully tell the story, Barbie and Ruth. Well, maybe when you hear the name Barbie, you do have some sense. We are going to be talking today about the Barbie doll, and about the woman who helped create her. Barbie and Ruth, the story of the world's most famous doll and the woman who created her. Robin Gerber has written a fascinating book here about Ruth Handler, who is the woman largely responsible for that iconic doll called the Barbie doll. And it's a story not only about that, about a groundbreaking development in the toy business, in the doll business, but also the story of a woman at the top of a company at a time when that was exceedingly uncommon. It is also, unfortunately, a story that does not end very happily. It is the story of Mattel and of some great difficulties which they experience. Getting a little too big, maybe a little too quickly, or growing in ways that proved to be unwise, a complicated story which Robin Gerber helps us to untangle. Her previous books include Leadership the Eleanor Roosevelt Way, Timeless Strategies from the First Lady of Courage, Catherine Graham, The Leadership Journey of an American Icon, and a novel called Eleanor versus Ike. And she is a lawyer and senior faculty for the Gallup Organization, a senior fellow in the executive education at the Robert H. Smith School of Business, the University of Maryland. And I am very happy to be speaking with her about her fascinating book, Barbie and Ruth, published by HarperCollins. Robin Gerber, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have to say, I got a couple of long looks from people at the health club as I read this book on the treadmill. I mean, as they kind of spot the cover and see that image of the lower part of one leg of a Barbie doll. But my word, this is a fascinating story. How did you first become acquainted with the story of Ruth Handler? And at what point did it become apparent to you that this was a story worth telling in this kind of detail?
Well, I first learned about Ruth Handler from a book, actually, that was put out called Enterprising Women, about other women business owners. And she was in this book, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. The Barbie doll was actually created by a woman. I had no idea. And then as I investigated, I discovered that she had also founded Mattel Toy Company, one of the great American companies. And then, of course, as I read more about her story, I learned that besides building this great company and doing lots of innovative things as a business person, she then had this tragic fall from grace where she overextended the company, as you alluded to, and was convicted of fraud, and also had breast cancer at the same time. So this terribly tragic period in her life. But then she redeems herself, comes back, founds a new company making prosthetic inserts for women who lost their breasts to cancer, and really becomes a hero to breast cancer survivors. And 10 years ago at Barbie's 40th anniversary celebration, Mattel had her sitting at the head table. So it's a great story of success and failure and coming back.
Hmm. It's also the story of an intriguing partnership and marriage between she and her husband, Elliot. Talk for just a moment about what an intriguing pair they were and of how important he was in this story and in the story of the Barbie doll.
Yes, it's a wonderful love story. We're coming up to Valentine's Day, so it's appropriate to talk about that part of it. They met, they were both children of immigrants, of Polish-Jewish immigrants living in Denver. They met when they were 16 years old, and they were together for over 65 years. Elliot was a wonderful designer and artist, very creative person, but a very, very shy person. Ruth used to say he couldn't order his own food in a restaurant, but she believed in him every one of those years, and when he started making things, she said, I'm going to sell these. It started with ashtrays and trinkets made out of a new plastic material called Lucite, and, of course, then ended up with toys.
I want to read a description you give us of their partnership. You say, Ruth and Elliot's unique partnership established many of its patterns in those early days. She had an optimistic view no matter the situation and kept Elliot's spirits up. She had a boisterous adventurism that pulled him along, and he had a quiet, steady, unwavering love for her. And at the end of their work days, there was much to talk, share, and dream about. I mean, I think many partnerships are, in a sense, unlikely in the way that this one was. I mean, kind of odd pairings, balancing of opposites, and so on. But it's really fascinating to be able to follow this partnership and to see how it worked for these two.
Yes, it was very complementary in the way that they sort of filled in each other's gaps, I guess you could say. And, you know, certainly Ruth was a lot more volatile and quick to react, quick to get angry, and Elliot was always the calm one. He was the one, the very, very steady one. But as that passage suggests, he was also the one who didn't have that kind of absolute optimism, absolute confidence that I think you need if you're going to found a business and build a huge business like she did.
By the way, tell us about his name. I mean, what his name ultimately became.
Oh, that is an interesting story. He was, as a young man, he was called Izzy because his name was Itzhak Elliot Handler. And in the community where he grew up, they called him Izzy as a nickname. And when they were driving across the desert after they were married, to live in Los Angeles, Ruth turns to him and she says, I'd like you to start calling yourself Elliot now that we're starting a new life. Because Izzy, frankly, sounds too Jewish. And she was concerned about anti-Semitism. She'd experienced some anti-Semitism against her brother, who was nicknamed Muzzy, and some police officers. There had been an incident where they had made fun of him for that name in a very anti-Semitic way. And so I think she was worried about it, and it made her uncomfortable going to this new place. She wasn't, I think they were, you know, as many children of immigrants, they were trying to fit in. And so she said, would you change your name and start calling yourself Elliot? I like it a lot better. Hmm. And he said, sure. So he started to be called Elliot.
You say unconsciously they were moving away from their roots and edging closer to assimilation, heading toward a storybook realization of the American dream. They are in Los Angeles, I believe, as this business venture first gets underway. And I want you to tell our listeners the fascinating story about the first order which was placed for some of their goods at a moment in time when they didn't even have letterhead or anything official to even write down an order. Tell our listeners that great story.
Oh, yes. Well, Ruth went into a very high-end store, you know, a very fancy gift shop in Los Angeles, and just marches in with some of Elliot's designs. Now, at this point, he is making things out of lucite that are really like ashtrays, bookends, just kind of, you know, incidental sort of small items. And she takes these into the store and she says, you know, you ought to buy these. And the owner of the store says, well, I have to come and see your workshop. Well, their workshop was basically a garage, a messy garage. And so she says, well, come on Saturday because she wants to be there. And she had a day job at Paramount Studios. So, and she figures Elliot can't handle this, you know. So this man shows up and he looks around. He says, fine, you know, I'll place an order. It was their first order. For them, it was rather large. And Elliot realizes in a panic, he doesn't even have a piece of paper. So he sort of tears off the end of a bag or something and writes down this order. And as soon as this man leaves, they're jumping up and down and screaming because this is actually the first order of what would eventually become Mattel Toy Company.
Tell us about that jump which they make from household items into the toy business.
Yeah. Well, what happens is they're making these items, and Ruth actually gets pregnant and has to stay home, so she can't be part of that company. Elliot gets a partner, and they form a company called Elzac, which is making these trinkets and women's jewelry, costume jewelry. And Ruth, meanwhile, can't really stand staying home, so she's going to go back into business, and she decides to sell, again, some of Elliot's designs, which were picture frames. But he is also tinkering on the side with making dollhouse furniture out of these little pieces of scrap wood and other materials. And sure enough, she finds she can sell the dollhouse furniture. So that was really the first kind of toy that they made. And Elliot just liked toys. When I interviewed him, he said, well, I'm really a kid at heart. I still love toys.
Hmm. We're speaking with Robin Gerber, and we're talking about her book, Barbie and Ruth. So one of the most interesting breakthroughs which occurs with this development of this thing which came to be known as the Barbie doll was an entirely new idea about what a doll should be and what kind of dolls girls would most enjoy playing with. This is one of the most basic things that I never knew until I read your book. Until the Barbie doll came along, what kind of dolls did girls play with?
Yeah, if you were a little girl, as I was in the 1950s, you could really, to actually play with a three-dimensional doll, you would get a baby doll. That's what you would get. And so you would play it being mommy. And that was it. Really wasn't much else you could play at when you had a baby doll. But Ruth noticed that her daughter and her friends were often playing with paper dolls, because paper dolls, of course, were adult dolls. And I remember also playing with paper dolls for that same reason, that I wanted to play at being an adult. And Ruth saw this and said, well, little girls really want to play at being big girls. Let's give them a doll to do it with. But it took her quite a while, a number of years, to convince her designers that mothers would possibly buy a doll for their daughters that had breasts. The men just couldn't imagine such a thing happening.
Hmm. You know, it's really interesting to think about. As she observed this, her daughter and her friends playing with these flimsy paper dolls and mimicking adult conversation and, I mean, taking on the role of grown-up women and obviously enjoying it, you know, she realizes if girls find themselves wanting to do that with something like a paper doll, imagine what they might do if they had something more realistic in their hands. I mean, realistic, I suppose, with quotes around it, but I mean, what if they had a real doll versus a paper doll? I mean, what a brilliant insight that is.
Yeah, and I think, as I say in the book, I think it was, she always said, oh, I thought of this because I saw my daughter playing with paper dolls. But I think there was something deeper going on, which is that she was a little girl who always wanted to be a bigger girl. And she didn't play at it because she was the 10th child of her parents. and last child, her mother was ill after she was born and gave her to be raised by her oldest sister. Now, this sister never had other children and worked all the time with her husband, owned a store, owned a deli counter. And when she was 10 years old, Ruth said to her sister slash mother, "I want to go to work." And at 10 years old, she was working behind the counter in this deli, and she describes not really having many friends, that she just loved to work and be around adults. So if you think about it, she was that little girl who wanted to be a big girl. So I think that was where the insight really came from.
Now, she has this idea that Mattel should make a new kind of doll, but unfortunately, she is unable to convince her own designers that it makes sense or that it can be done. Tell us about the discovery she makes during a trip to Europe, which in a sense ends up making all the difference in making all this happen.
Yes, it did, because these male designers at Mattel did not want to make this doll. They gave her all kinds of excuses. You know, one excuse was that they couldn't mold such a doll with these tiny hands and feet with the current kind of plastics that they had at the time in the molding processes, or that it would cost too much money to do it. Well, then she goes on a trip to Europe in 1955 with her family, and in a toy shop window in Luzern, Switzerland, sees a doll that you and I would think of as Barbie. But in fact, this doll started its life a few years before that as the three-dimensional realization of a cartoon character, and a very popular cartoon character named Lily in one of the German newspapers. And Lily in the cartoons is actually a prostitute. And the cartoonist who made this cartoon had the idea that men would like a gag toy of Lily. And so Lily was born as a gag sex toy for men. But even in Europe, little girls saw this toy doll and said, "I want that." And so it had gradually worked its way into toy shops, and that's when Ruth found the doll, brought it home. Her daughter wanted one. She got one for her daughter, two for herself. Went back to Mattel and handed it to her designer and said, "Figure out how to make this. This is the doll I've been talking about."
Well, and of course, when you hand over a doll to somebody who says it can't be done, that's all the proof you need that in fact it can be done. I mean, somebody is doing it, and we need to do it too.
Exactly.
By the way, you do make mention at some point that ultimately the company responsible for the Lily doll goes after Mattel. I mean, believing, and to some extent probably quite rightly, that their idea and design had, in a sense, been stolen.
Yes. Well, it was, wasn't it? And they did. They brought a suit. They went through various machinations. But at the end of the day, Mattel bought the rights to the Lily doll for about $20,000.
Getting these actually made is an interesting challenge, and you tell us that some of the complications came because much of the manufacturing actually occurred in Japan, and due to the language and cultural barriers of the time, there were some interesting mistakes made and miscommunications in terms of very important details, including some important details of Barbie's body.
Exactly. This was the beginning of, you know, companies going to Japan for the cheap workforce over there. And so Mattel had done this. They had started going to Japan to manufacture toys. This was a new kind of plastic they were using, a new kind of molding process. Actually, the Japanese didn't know how to do it any better than the Americans, and so the engineers were struggling over there to figure out how to make this doll. And as you say, they were also struggling to understand what this doll was supposed to look like. The Japanese really didn't like this doll very much. They didn't like her looks. And they kept forming her with nipples on those breasts. And Mattel didn't quite want to go that far. And so finally, Jack Ryan, who was the engineer in charge of this over in for Mattel over in Japan, one day he just got so frustrated, he took out a file and just filed off those those nipples so that the Japanese would finally understand that Barbie was just supposed to have those smooth breasts that we know that she has today. So there were definitely some humorous missteps.
Right. And, of course, you outline other important details such as the rotational molding, which gave Barbie that ability to move and twist and so on, which we know very well. Of course, another big breakthrough, besides the fact that Barbie is an adult, is also the fact that she would have all of these different outfits, all of these different sorts of clothes. That's the kind of thing we just take for granted now. It's just such a ubiquitous part of the doll business, but apparently this was quite unprecedented, at least here in America.
Yeah, that was another great innovation of Ruth's. From the minute she saw that Lily doll, she went in and she said, okay, I'd like these three dolls, and then I'd like some more outfits. And they said, oh, no, there's no other outfits. You buy the doll. You want another outfit? You buy another doll. And Ruth said, thought to herself, well, that's the stupidest thing in the world. Let's just sell the doll, and we'll make all kinds of clothes. And children can just buy the other clothes, which, of course, was the genius of this. It was the razor blade theory, as Elliot liked to say. Once you buy the razor, you got to get those razor blades.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a huge part, of course, of the Barbie market, became the pieces of clothing that you could get. And even today, a doll is quite cheap. You can get a Barbie for as cheap as $5. But then the company knows you're going to buy all those clothes and accessories.
Hmm. So it is successful fairly soon, but not immediately. Tell us about at least the brief hesitancy on the part of stores to purchase and stock this doll.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, it was quite a shock for Ruth. She unveiled the doll March 9th, 1959, at the Toy Fair, had a big, beautiful display for Barbie, and all these male buyers came in from the stores, including Sears, which was a very big buyer at the time. And they looked at this doll and turned up their noses and walked out, and she got very few orders and was absolutely devastated, calling Japan in a panic because she'd ordered so much inventory. And the worst thing in the toy business is to have inventory that you can't get out of the warehouse. Well, she had also done something very innovative, which was to make a television commercial for this doll that really portrayed Barbie as a real person. And no doll had ever been advertised this way. And after Toy Fair, little girls started seeing this television ad. Not too much happened for a couple of months, but then they got out of school. And once they were out of school for summer break, they started demanding this doll from their parents, and suddenly demand shot up, and it took 3 years for Mattel to actually catch up with demand after that.
It's probably important for us to understand, too, that that this doll was being marketed in a way that was quite unprecedented, that if I remember correctly, commercials before then had decidedly been pointed at parents, and these were commercials which were designed with little kids in mind.
Yes, we have Ruth Handler to thank for that. That actually started in 1955 when Disney started that show, The Mickey Mouse Club. And for the first time, they offered the opportunity to toy companies to advertise for the entire year. In fact, you had to advertise for the entire year if you wanted to advertise on the Mickey Mouse Club. Now, toy companies had never done that. They only advertised right before Christmas. And actually, they didn't go on TV very often. They mostly advertised in catalogs. And some people will remember those catalogs were aimed at parents, advising parents what toys to buy for their kids, so that children were not really being considered as consumers. Ruth changed all that, and we might love her or hate her for it, but she bought into the Mickey Mouse Club, bet her whole worth of her company, $500,000, to buy those ads for a year, and of course it paid off magnificently.
But it did
change the way toys were sold, because yep, now ads were aimed at kids, and kids were the ones demanding what would be bought.
In fact, someone who worked for her told a reporter, and you quote him this way, that retailers were irked because television advertising undercut their influence in the industry. The ads forced them to buy what Mattel advertised, that is, the stores. It used to be store buyers dictated what toys would sell, meaning the stores themselves, but Mattel reversed that, and all of this became much more public-driven, which
is, again,
that's the kind of thing that we can't even imagine that world because it is so much the reverse, and we are so entrenched in exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and also the idea that this really single-handedly, Ruth Handler did make this change, and there are many books that credit Mattel and, you know, her this change that she made and she came up with. She had the vision, and this is the thing about founders of companies, people who build great companies, having that big vision of how things can be changed to benefit their company.
So she goes on to design variations on Barbie, and of course along comes Ken and Skipper and others, and all kinds of things. Eventually Mattel expands into other ventures, including Hot Wheels, which are incredibly popular and successful. Then things begin to go wrong. In whatever time remains to us, tell us about kind of the way in which all of this falls apart.
Yeah, well, in 1970, Ruth believes that Mattel's a $300 million company and there's just no more room to grow. And so she has the idea to start buying up other companies. Ringling Brothers Circus became a Mattel company. They bought a movie company, made the movie Sounder. But they were buying these companies with Mattel stock, which was very highly valued. And then comes a bad quarter. Profits are down. Can't let Wall Street know because that'll sink the stock price. And so Ruth cooks the books and is caught in doing this along with some of her other executives and is convicted of SEC of fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Ends up with the longest community service sentence ever given to a white-collar criminal up to that time. But lucky she didn't go to jail.
Hmm.
I think the judge actually took pity on her because during this terrible ordeal with the company, she also got breast cancer.
That gives us the opportunity.
She lost a breast.
Let's talk then just briefly about Nearly Me, which is a very important undertaking for her.
Well, when terrible things happen to people, they can do all kinds of things and crawl into holes, but that wasn't Ruth's way. She went back to her core skills, building a company, and she founded a new company, as you said, Nearly Me, making breast prosthetics inserts for bras for women who'd had mastectomies like herself. She built a woman-owned company, went around and fitted women personally, had a great experience for herself, and just became a hero to women who had suffered from breast cancer and losing a breast because now they could look good again and have their dignity back. So it was a great redemptive thing that she did for herself and for other women.
Much more in the pages of this fascinating book, Barbie and Ruth, published by HarperCollins. Robin Gerber, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Monday on The Morning Show, you'll hear the memorable interview that I recorded with Jay Tunney, one of the sons of Gene Tunney, one of history's most formidable boxers, who twice defeated the great Jack Dempsey. Gene Tunney, in addition to being a great boxer, was a remarkably intelligent and cultured man, and he counted among his closest friends George Bernard Shaw. Jay Tunney's book about his father focuses in particular upon this uncommon friendship. It's called The Prize Fighter and the Playwright. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And to hear a different morning show 7 days a week, subscribe to The Morning Show